All right, I don't know what time it is on your clock, but I know what I'm getting ready for. It is time for the Professional CISO Podcast with David Malico.
Welcome, one and all, to the Professional CISO Podcast. I'm your host, David Malico. This show is an exploration of the topics necessary to transform the CISO role into one of a professional. Welcome to the show. This is going to be a solo show. Yes, your best dreams come true. You get to hear me talk for the duration of an entire episode. This is unique and one of a kind. No, I wouldn't say one of a kind. One of a kind for me so far. Obviously, we've had guests on, but really what I want to do with this one is report the facts and then move into some thoughts and ponderances on a specific subject. So before we do that, I do want to do a shout out to our foundation sponsors. I want to talk about Interpris Security with founders Nick Lanta, the CEO, Michael Jinks, CTO, and Ian Roth, head of product. So these guys have got together, got this platform up. They're stitching everything together with an intelligence layer for continuous threat and exposure management. Go check them out. Also, I want to talk about ContraForce with CEO Stan Golubchik and CTO Ricky Melendez. Again, pushing the boundaries when it comes to hyper-automation for security operations. Check those guys out as well. I want to thank both of those organizations for supporting us early when it comes to the Professional CISO Podcast. Now, in this episode, we're going to cover the SEC and the CISO. It's really a new world out there. So we're going to talk about the SEC, the case they brought against CISO Tim Brown and SolarWinds, and wind up with some observations and recommendations. Now, I do want to kind of call out a little bit. One thing I have noticed in a lot of my conversations is I hear a lot of folks talk about this case, but very, very few have read the entire complaint. Kind of makes you think when it comes to experts. So of note, I have read the entire complaint, which is where I got most of the content for this episode. So let's move that forward. So now let's talk about being a professional CISO. I do want to start out with some disclaimers. I am not an attorney, nor am I dispensing legal advice. This is just one CISO's opinion based on conclusions and opinions rooted in available information. This content is intended to further the conversation around the professionalization of the role of the CISO. That's it, no more. Now, in this episode, I do read some things for reference. So instead of me being kind of off the cuff and conversational, I will actually quote some things. This is to make sure that I provide the facts and correct context on any given point, okay? I just want to make sure that I'm precise. Definitely don't want to get out there over my skis. So that being said, let's get started. Let's do a little background. So on October 30th, 2023, the SEC announced charges against Tim Brown and SolarWinds, alleging, quote, from at least its October 2018 initial public offering through at least its December 2020 announcement that it was the target of a massive nearly two-year-long cyber attack dubbed Sunburst, SolarWinds and Brown defrauded investors by overstating SolarWinds cybersecurity practices and understating or failing to disclose known risks, unquote. Now, let's go into the core assertions by the SEC in the complaint. Now, they allege that there were false statements and omissions that were publicly made that deceived investors. They allege that this was mainly performed through a security statement on the SolarWinds website. The false statements and omissions in the security statement fall into really four general categories. One, compliance with the NIST framework for evaluating cybersecurity practices. Two, using a secure development lifecycle when creating software for customers. Three, having strong password protection. And four, maintaining good access controls. Now, I do want to do a little quick side note here. You in the cybersecurity realm, what is the threshold for good practices? How do you measure it? So let's just take that aside. So what did the SEC get right? Now, I do agree with the core premise of the SEC's position. Truly, a company should not publish public statements about their cybersecurity posture. They're not true and correct, and that would mislead investors. Now, we all know this is a fine line, but at the same time, you have to have the core fundamentals of what you're communicating to your investor base be on sound principles. They have to be on sound foundation. So according to the examples presented in the complaint, SolarWinds looked to have had an issue with, and again, keeping things at face value, they did look to have an issue with deploying and utilizing a secure development lifecycle. They also seem to have, again, according to the complaint, consistent password controls across the enterprise. Basically meaning they were inconsistent in how they deployed their password controls. Also, they had significant recognized challenges regarding access control. So all those, again, that's really kind of face value, but I think the other side of this is who doesn't? I mean, that would be the other thing, right? And I think we all have challenges in those areas. But I think this goes into kind of the next piece, which is, what did the SEC in their investigation that led them down this other path, and which is what I call, what did the SEC get wrong, or where are they off base? So in my opinion, in reading the complaint, the SEC erodes the strength of their position by exhibiting that they don't understand really the fundamentals of cybersecurity, which is of concern, especially when you're talking an enforcement action like this. The complaint indicates that SolarWinds follows the NIST Cybersecurity Framework, or CSF. But then they immediately describe how SolarWinds assesses itself against the moderate level framework of NIST Special Publication 800-53 Revision 4, Security and Privacy Controls for Federal Information Systems and Organizations, or NIST 800-53, which we all tend to mostly know, right? So the complaint goes on to cover how SolarWinds was not compliant with a vast majority of the 325 NIST 800-53 controls, and then it says nothing of the 108 actual NIST CSF controls. And I think you can kind of get to see where I'm going here. The complaint says nothing of how the NIST 800-53 is a menu of specific controls with auditability, and that the NIST CSF is a simple and flexible framework that organizations use to enhance their cybersecurity posture. So let's take that for a second and say, really, those are two different things. Both of those statements came from NIST itself in my research. So to me, this shows a fundamental lack of understanding of the relationship between the NIST CSF and NIST 800-53. How can you try to hold someone accountable for misreporting the status of their cybersecurity program when you do not understand the foundational aspects of the frameworks that are in use, or at least the NIST publications that are in use, right? NIST CSF is a framework, NIST 800-53 is a publication. So I'm gonna go straight into the complaint. Let's go to section 82, and I quote, a September 2019 email attached an internal FedRAMP security controls assessment conducted by a SolarWinds compliance employee against the 300 plus controls of the NIST framework discussed above. So we're saying we have 300 plus controls, but we're calling it the NIST framework. Words matter, intent matters. So were they being held accountable to the NIST CSF or the NIST 800-53? The NIST CSF does not have 300 plus controls, reinforcing the point that the SEC is conflating the two publications and does not understand their role in cybersecurity. The SEC references the NIST framework, quote unquote, many times in the complaint to reinforce the point that SolarWinds cybersecurity was deficient. Now, I'm not arguing that SolarWinds cybersecurity was deficient. What I am arguing is that we can definitely make people's cybersecurity look much worse if we decide to conflate two different types of publications from NIST. The result is to attempt to amplify the degree by which SolarWinds and specifically Brown were negligent. If the SEC's predicate were correct, would this amplification be as effective, knowing that the two publications were drastically different? I mean, that's where I start getting a little fuzzy, right? Where it's like, okay, so if you're gonna conflate these two things, you're gonna use one of 325 controls instead of 100 and some that are gonna make me look much worse in compliance to the NIST framework. And keep in mind, this complaint goes to a judge. And so we're going to rely on the judge having cybersecurity expertise. That's debatable, right? If anything, it's probably not likely. So let's go back to another simple example of the SEC's lack of fundamental understanding of cybersecurity. In section 148, I quote, in March 2020, SolarWinds learned that a threat actor had attacked SolarWinds MSPs using a list of 19,000 single sign-on customers, meaning that the threat actors had information to distinguish between customers who had enabled more secure multi-factor authentication and customers who did not have it enabled. This was another red flag that malicious actors had access to SolarWinds network and/or systems, unquote. Excuse me? So you hear that on the surface and you say, okay, SSO and MFA, single sign-on and multi-factor authentication, are two distinctly different technologies with different security control implications. Just because an organization uses SSO doesn't mean MFA is or is not enabled. Now, I'm not sure how you would define MFA use simply by a list of SSO customers or, you know, absent configuration data. But in the end, at a minimum, this is an oversimplification of the situation. Again, I think it's a case of trying to bolster that case and hoping potentially that someone may just kind of overlook it. Now, moving a little bit more forward, I think we talk about the situation relative to the publication of information. And so let's talk about Tim Brown or even SolarWinds and who has the authority to publish public statements. So the SEC complaint references the security statement on the SolarWinds website numerous times, and they tie it to Tim Brown as if he had the sole authority to publish the statement, as well as to keep it updated. So, was Tim Brown, the CISO, that reported to the CIO and was three levels below the CEO, given carte blanche to publish anything he desired on the company website? Or did SolarWinds leadership review and approve Tim Brown's writings? So that leads us down the path to, is it the intent of the SEC to hold only the person that wrote or spoke about a subject accountable, regardless of the approval process required, or that the person could have been compelled to do this by their own leadership as part of their job? Interesting questions. Also, does the SEC have the same level of requirement for other officers and executives of public companies? Again, it's almost as if they have an absence of understanding or absence of wanting to understand that there might be an approval process that would bring in other folks. In the essence of time, I'm going to roll into kind of the takeaways because I could go on quite a bit for this. There's plenty there and we also have an appeal and a counter to the appeal and I'm sure we'll get into those in the near future. But ultimately for this and just kind of the core of it, let's go to takeaways. And honestly, it's not an exhaustive list. Just think of it as kind of these large bubbles of thought. First and foremost, I would say as a CISO, the thing that I was taught just reading this, that my first takeaway coming out of reading this complaint was do not hold on to risk. It seemed like Tim Brown was doing that to some degree. He was being a good leader in his company, and he was holding on to some risk that maybe more than maybe what he could or should. So I know there's CISOs out there that own virtually all the technology risks for their organization. And I also know that there's CISOs out there advocating for people in our role to own the risk, quote unquote. I think you need to work to change that to an environment where the business leaders own the risk for their areas of responsibility. I don't think we as CISOs can own that. You should work continuously to identify and assign risk to the appropriate parties. Now, I'm not saying to not be a good partner to other business leaders. That's not what I'm saying at all. And I'm not saying CISOs don't have a piece of the risk, by all means. And I'm also not saying that CISOs should remove themselves from assisting business units from risk scenarios. No, that's what we're there for. That's where our value lies. What I am saying is CISOs must partner with business leaders on risk situations, with ultimate risk ownership remaining with the business. I mean, they are the best suited to make the final business risk decision. I'm also saying CISOs must act as technology risk advisor to their business constituents. Be that strong partner. But again, that doesn't mean you have to own the risk. You don't have to own all the risk. You can track it. You can be good partners and even be a good proactive person around it. That doesn't mean you have to own it. Also, CISOs must educate their stakeholders where business risk, technology risk, and cyber risk intersect. That's where a huge piece of our value lies. We must own the cyber-specific portion of any given risk equation. Yes, 100%, absolutely. That's the pure, unadulterated artillery that we bring to the table, right? Is that cyber-specific portion. And then out from that is the technology piece, out from that is the business piece. And again, being able to take that, move that risk, and empower those business leaders to own that risk is the key to making sure that we are not put in a place where we bring on too much risk for ourselves. Now, let's think about it for a second. If you can't reassign that risk, one thing you can do is make sure that it's identified, documented properly, right, and appropriately rated. at least to the best of your ability, and then consult with other people and make sure that a rating is appropriate, and then communicate it to your leadership. Now, a lot of folks may say this is a CYA. In the end, I think this is the basis for what we should do in any given situation, whether we are able to transfer or to hand that risk off to someone else or not. I think us having ability to document that risk, rate it, and at least give our perspective on it is a good starting place. So this should be table stakes as it is anyway. So another takeaway is, don't make aspirational statements about the nature of your cybersecurity, public or private, right? And that even goes into conferences, roundtables, things like that. I think sharing stories is one thing, and being able to talk about your challenges, yes. But I think going out and saying that we're good, we're not good, putting a maturity rating scale, things like that, I would say be very, very cautious, right? Because you never know exactly where that's going to wind up. And obviously, there are people out there looking for those type of things. Today's episode is sponsored by ContraForce. When you need to get maximum productivity from your existing Microsoft security stack and other leading tools, you should be working with ContraForce. Specifically targeted at the MSP and MSSP space, ContraForce reduces security operations complexity and empowers the next generation of security response through generative security operations. And it is all possible leveraging an organization's existing security tools. The ContraForce SecOps workspace reduces complexity for the security analyst by automating time-consuming tasks across in-customer detection and response tools, empowering them with insights and frictionless access to information and remediations. The result is massive improvement in analyst efficiency and security effectiveness. ContraForce eliminates security fatigue. They have increased speed of connector deployment, one-click incident response, and they stack responses with incident response gamebooks. To see ContraForce in action and to learn how you can reduce your SecOps complexity and churn while leveraging your existing tools, visit www.contraforce.com. We appreciate ContraForce's support as a foundation sponsor of the Professional CISO podcast. The complaint reads as if Brown were the central figure that pulled the puppet strings of the senior leadership team. It outlines multiple times where the CISO was informed of issues with SDLC and NIST, and at the same time, other executives, to include the CIO and CTO, were also made aware. So, most CISOs don't own and cannot directly require other teams, such as development and IT, to implement the changes necessary to become compliant with maturity improvements. So I find it interesting that we have this complaint that's sitting there that is written in a way to say that Tim Brown was just a mastermind, and he was moving these things forward, and it all relies on him, and that there would be nobody else. You know, a simple logical question could be, why were other technology executives not held accountable to at least the same level, if not more, due to their level of seniority? If not that, then even maybe company either directors or officers. It's interesting that they would take this route to go directly to the CISO, again, that's buried four levels deep in the organization. So back to what I just said, basically, which is the SEC should have held other executives and officers accountable, not just the technology officers, right? There is more shared, and suing a company is much different than suing an individual. And then ultimately, SEC should have filed separately against Brown, from my opinion, right? And honestly, if at all. And then if there was something there, it was minimal charges that reflect accurate cybersecurity principles, right? Not conflating two different type of frameworks or publications from NIST, not making it to where here's a guy buried four levels deep in an organization that he's this puppet master that's making sure that everything's going the way he wants it to. And then I think they had an opportunity to empower the CISO through that nature, right? I'm not saying a slap on the wrist. If the guy did something wrong, I think he needs to be held accountable. But at the same time, if you're bolstering your case without a fundamental understanding of cybersecurity, that really smacks of something. You're trying to do something else there, right? So it does look also like they're trying to legislate through the court system, and maybe that's where I was leading to. I would say is it's a case of they're just really trying to pin something somewhere, and it looks to be, you know, maybe not the right place. And I'm not saying that as a CISO. It's just it doesn't match up. So they took a weak case against a CISO, and is it to hold them accountable, and without having that understanding. and not having the understanding of how different roles engage an organization, what the governance structure looks like, and what the true power of a CISO has. Now, if they're trying to push them into a whistleblower role, that's a little bit different. And I think the concern there is nobody wants to be in that position. At the same time, nobody wants to slit their own throat when it comes to their livelihood, right? So there's a lack of practicality in that. So I think there's some downstream things with this approach that we need to be aware of, right? And so what are they trying to accomplish by only going after the CISO versus, you know, what they may get by just staying on this path? And I can't say what they're after. Like my logical brain goes to, here's where they're at. Here, you know, I can usually kind of follow some logic. In this case, I'm not following that path, truly. And my brain tends to go to other types of motivation. And you can call it political, you can call it moving the Overton window, things like that. And honestly, on my behalf, that would be conjecture. I don't know what it is, but it's the equation is not adding up for me. But what is the reality of this, right? In this case, it reinforces the CISO scapegoat trope where, you know, just let's find another way to get the CISO in a place where they're the scapegoat. You know, bad cybersecurity. I don't care if you're four levels deep. I don't care if you're you have two other technology leaders that you report to that knew about a lot of these things as well, or many of these things. We're still going to hold you accountable directly. So it becomes very scapegoat feeling. I think it also pushes increased risk on a role that historically doesn't have the protections of other C-suite roles. You hear everybody talk about this. I'm not going to go too deep into it. You talk about DNO, you talk about being an actual officer. In this case, what we're doing is we're increasing the accountability without increased protections. And that gets a little dicey, especially again, when you're talking about someone's livelihood. This also creates a bottom-up enforcement that will drive good people out of the role. That's one of my big concerns, right? This is, and think of it as kind of this natural course. You increase the risk for the role without really increasing the protections, and then good people move to the sidelines, right? What happens is for lack of a better way to put it, you have underqualified people move into that role. Well, that doesn't build us. That doesn't build that community. That doesn't put us where we need to be. Think of every single organization becomes less secure. I mean, think of it from a fourth level supply chain. If you have a fourth level supply chain and that person is, you know, maybe, yeah, it's a smaller company, but what level are they getting at to be a CISO or a senior level cybersecurity executive or practitioner in that fourth level supply chain? Yeah, I mean, those are becoming very real. I think there's the potential for eventually sidelining or even elimination of the CISO role. Now, I think elimination might be a little strong, but we could get replaced by it with one or more roles that have higher expertise or clout. And that's a concern, right? I think we're trying to do better. I think we're trying to get ourselves, again, more professionalized, hence the reason for this podcast. And this, even though SEC says the intent of this to is empower the CISO, it seems to be having kind of the opposite effect. So in this episode, we covered quite a bit. So the SEC's case against Tim Brown and SolarWinds. We did talk about how the SEC, at least through its filing, shows to have exhibited its ignorance related to cybersecurity. I struggle for another explanation where details matter, especially in cybersecurity, especially in technology risk. And in this case, there's a lot of it that's kind of glanced over in that complaint, or at least it's conflated. And that's a concern. And then it's what's, the change is being driven for sure. I think we can all definitely say that that's happening, but to what end? And I'm not doomsdaying it. It's not to say that some of the things are not positive. But I will say this, there tends to be much more negative than what I see in positive with this, at least at this time. So hopefully we can get ourselves in a place where we understand this, we understand what the intent is behind it. And finally, I say, colleagues and friends, I renew the call. We must professionalize the role of the CISO. Until next time, I wish you health, happiness, and success in your pursuit of becoming the professional CISO. Let's do this.
We're professionalizing the CISO role, so please subscribe to the Professional CISO Podcast.